I must first express my appreciation for the privilege to be a participant in an effort such as this that has so much potential for good. So many great things came out of last year's effort, and we know that this year we'll only build upon that, and we're certainly encouraged by being so close and so available. And so we appreciate the elders of this congregation, Wayne, and all of those who have worked so hard to put this together and provide this opportunity for us. The father of Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah was concerned about them. And so he sent his younger son to go and to see how they fared. And as he went and came to the area where his brothers were, he saw a battle going on. It was between the Israelites and the Philistines. And as he gathered there, he went among the soldiers and began to question them concerning one of the warriors on the other side. Earlier, for 40 days, this great warrior came out and he stood before the people, before the Israelites, and he proclaimed, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." He had made an earlier proposition before those 40 days where he came out each day and said, "Bring out a warrior and we'll fight. And if I prevail and if I win, then the Israelites will be the slaves of the Philistines. But if he prevails, then the Philistines will be the slaves of the Israelites." Well, as he's questioning those in the army, his older brother hears him. And he comes to him and rebukes him. He says, "I know your pride. I know why you're here. Why have you not stayed with the sheep? You just wanted to come and to see the battle." And when he was rebuked, the young man said, "Is there not a cause?" 1 Samuel 17 and verse 9. Well, as we consider this situation, we probably, most of us, already have an idea of what we're talking about. And that is, we're looking at the events that surrounded David and Goliath. And as we look at David, we'll remember that he said, "I'll go out and I'll fight the giant." And they wanted to put the armor of the king on, but it was untried, and so he didn't do that. He took his staff, he went down to the brook, he picked up 5 smooth river rocks. He had a sling with him, he put them in his shepherd's scrip that he had with him. And then he went out, and when the giant saw him, he was incensed that they would send a boy out to fight a man's battle. And he told him that he was going to feed his flesh to the birds of the air and to the wild animals. And I want to turn, if you will, to 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 42 through 47, and I want you to hear the record of the inspired writer. It is thrilling to listen to the words of this young boy, this young man, if you please. It says in verse 42, 1 Samuel 17, "And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and a fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." Here's how David responded. "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defiled. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. And I will give the carcass of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air, and to the wild beasts in the earth. And all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." Let's stop right there for a moment. A lesson to be learned. Here we see a context where this young man, David, understands not only do the Philistines need to be taught a lesson, there is a God in heaven, but the Israelites needed to learn that lesson too. There is a God in heaven, and that He is the God of Israel. And he goes on in verse 47, "And all this assembly shall know, the Philistines, the Israelites, everyone here shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands." Well, we know what happens, don't we? It says that David would haste toward the Philistine. I can see it. They were on two mountains, the two armies hollering back and forth, and now here's this boy who's walking toward this soldier, this warrior, 9.5, 10 feet. Some believe he was even 11 feet tall. His armor that he wore weighed over 120 pounds. The spearhead on his spear weighed over 16 pounds. And here he comes, and it says he hasted toward him. He wasn't walking. He began to run, pulling out that one rock, putting it in a sling, spinning it around, and then letting go, and it planted into the forehead of the Philistine. He fell down. And here's a point I like. It might be just my sense of humor. I think it is a little bit humorous. David then took the sword of the giant and used his own sword to cut his head off. I like that. This all transpired in the Valley of Elah. Great lessons. How many lessons can we learn from just this one context of the Valley of Elah? Well, number one, look at David. You see, he took five small or smooth river rocks. He was ready for a battle. Did he know that he would lay down the giant with one throw? Not necessarily. He was ready to do his part. He knew it was God that was going to give him the victory. He knew it was God that would deliver this Philistine into his hand, but he was ready to do his part. He was ready for a battle, ready for a fight. Oh, many other lessons that we can learn as we go through. As we consider the valleys of the Bible, we remember that the Israelites usually would inhabit the highlands, the hill country. And very seldom did they gain control or full control of the valleys. In fact, it was to the point that the Syrians would say that the Lord is the God of the hills, but He is not the God of the valleys, 1 Kings 20 and verse 28. In that context, Jehovah says, I'm going to show them that I'm not only the God of the hills, but I'm also the God of the valleys. When you study the valleys of the Bible, they were areas that were, for the most part, very fertile. There were some exceptions, but predominantly they were very fertile. And they were excellent farmland. They provided for great crops and great produce. In fact, as we go to the Valley of Eshcol, you'll remember when the spies went in to spy out the land in the Promised Land. It was there that they grabbed and took those massive clusters of grapes and the pomegranates and the figs that they brought back to show what was in the land, and the land would flow with milk and honey, and that was very prosperous, as we see in Numbers chapter 13. It's interesting, had the Israelites obeyed the Lord, and had they carried out the task that Joshua began of clearing all of the people out of the land, it could have been a very productive time, a very productive season for the Israelites for a long time if they had followed Jehovah. But what happened is they didn't clear out the land, and the Canaanites would stay there, and too often they would learn the farming habits from the Canaanites. But you'll remember that oftentimes, as far as their crops were concerned, it was tied in directly to their idol worship, to their worship of the pagan deities, the fertility deities. And this would also seep into Israel, into their worship. And it would be a great plague for them. And it would be something that all of the prophets would have to address and deal with as far as Israelites were concerned, the idol worship. These all unfolded many times within the valleys of the Bible. What we want to do this evening is we want to take some time and notice some of the valleys. We won't have time to deal with all of them. We sang the lily of the valley, and we're not going to say anything else other than that in our sermon about that, but we are going to look at some of the valleys in the Bible and hopefully present some lessons for us that will challenge us and that will help us in our service. I want to start with the Valley of Jezreel. The Greek word for that is Esdraelon. And as we consider the Valley of Esdraelon, the Old Testament points to this as the entire valley that separated Galilee from Samaria. It was the valley that really drew the boundaries to the lands that were assigned to Zebulun and to Issachar. Joshua chapter 19 tells us. It was a large, fertile valley. There were two cities that were included, and one of those at the door was the city of Megiddo. The other was Tamach. Well, as we turn to the New Testament, we come to the book of Revelation, and we see a book of great symbolism. We see an apocalyptic book. We remember as we turn to Revelation chapter 16, and we look at verse 16, and as we consider that chapter, the bowls of God's wrath are being poured out. The vials of His wrath are being poured out. And in verse 16 it says, "And He gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon," or Harmageddon, as it might be called. It's interesting to note it doesn't say anything about the battle of Armageddon. It's also very interesting that our premillennial friends, they missed the whole point of the symbolism of this term that's being used. It has reference to this valley, the valley of Jezreel, the valley of Esdraelon, of Megiddo, if you please, the plains of Megiddo, the valley of Megiddo. All of these terms are found concerning this area. J.L. Hurlbut, in his work, he said that more battles have been fought on this plain than in any other in the whole world. When Napoleon saw Megiddo, he made this statement. He said all the armies of the world could make battle here. And that's the thrust of this. Megiddo was the city that was at the beginning of the entrance of Esdraelon. It was at the foothills of Mount Carmel and in that area. And when he mentions Armageddon, John does in Revelation chapter 16, he's not talking about future battles that would come in the great usherance in of the millennium. But what he's doing is he is taking their minds back to past battles, the history of this area. Considering as you go through some of the great battles that were there, we remember when we go to Judges, rather, chapters 4 and 5, we read of Deborah and Barak. We read of King Jabin there. He was a Canaanite king. His officer was Sisera. And it was in this battle. It was in this valley that the battle would go on. It says of the army of Sisera that they had 900 chariots of iron. It goes on to say concerning Israelite, of the 40,000 Israelite soldiers, they barely had a sword or a shield between them or a spear. And yet as we go through, we see that God gave them the victory. And in chapter 5, they sing of that victory. A decisive win for the good guys in that context. We continue to read in the book of Judges. We read of Gideon. And we remember there, 300, that was the final number as far as the soldiers that were with Gideon. And they were standing against the Midianites, 135,000 Midianites. If I've done my math right, that is 450-1. Every soldier to do his part had to kill 450 soldiers. But we remember what happened, don't we? They would encircle the camp. They would have their trumpets, their pots. They would have their lamps. They would blow their trumpets. They would break their pots. And at that point, the Midianites would kill of their own 120,000. It was in the valley of Jezreel, the valley of Esdraelon, of Megiddo. We go to 2 Kings chapter 9, and we look at verse 27, and we see King Ahaziah, the king of Judah, was killed there by Jehu's arrow. We go on and we continue to study, and we see so many other great battles that would go on, that would be carried out. Good King Josiah would battle with Pharaoh Necho, but he would be killed. Josiah would. You have to wonder. He was one of the contemporaries of Jeremiah. And you have to wonder just how much could have been accomplished had his life not been taken so early, as far as I was concerned. How much of the restoration and the reformation could have been accomplished through his hand had he lived? Saul would battle the Philistines here. It would be here that Elijah would meet with the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel, and he would taunt them, and he would be victorious over them. It came to be known, this valley did, came to be known as a great symbol for hard-fought battles that would end in decisive victories in this area. Sometimes the good guys would win. Sometimes the bad guys would win. And it emphasized the point, and that's what John's bringing out in Revelation chapter 16, that there is a constant battle going on between good and evil, between right and wrong, between God and the devil. And as we wage that war here, there are going to be victories that we will gain and that we can celebrate. But as we wage that battle here, there are going to be some defeats. Satan's going to win sometimes. Just stop and think about it. Just think about the congregation that you are part of, this congregation, Southwest, other congregations that are represented. And I'm confident that you can look across that congregation and you can see those men that are spiritually strong, spiritual giants, those who we know have gained victories, who have overcome because they stand where they stand. And yet we can look across these congregations and see faces that are missing, faces that gave in. We look across the history of our brotherhood, and I'm not talking about long time in the past. I'm talking about fairly recent history. Great soldiers of the cross have laid down the sword of the Spirit and who have turned over to denominationalism. The devil wins that battle. But ultimately, the message is Jehovah is going to be victorious. The devil might win a skirmish here and a skirmish there, but God's going to win overall. That's the point. That's the imagery that John wants us to see when he mentions this great valley, a valley where so many battles were fought. Great lessons for us to realize, to understand that no matter what unfolds, no matter how disappointed we may be at some of our brethren and what they may do, we still need to stand. And we still need to recognize that victory is guaranteed if we remain with Christ, if we follow Him whithersoever He goeth. Revelation chapter 14 and verse 4. Another well-known valley was the Valley of Hinnom. It was a deep, narrow ravine that ran south of Jerusalem. It, again, marked the boundary between Judah and Benjamin's territory, as we in Joshua chapter 15 and verse 8. But as early as the monarchy, we see that this valley would become associated with the pagan cults, with their worship of pagan deities, and with the practice of passing their children through the fire, if you please, to appease these deities of Moloch and Baal. It has a very sordid history. For as we go through God's Word, we see that the Israelites would join in with the pagans. They too would offer their children through the fire. Even two of their kings, Ahaz, Manasseh, 2 Kings 16 and verse 3. I wonder if that might be what Micah has in mind. In Micah chapter 6, what does the Lord require? Rivers of oil? Thousands of rams? The fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Could it be that he's referencing the Israelites and them bringing in these practices? We know that they did it. We have a record of that. Jeremiah would stand up and condemn the practice. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 32. And then in that time of Reformation, as we spoke of, with Jeremiah working and Josiah the king, Josiah would go down into this valley and he would defile the valley so that he would make it unacceptable to be considered a holy place. And he did so for the purpose of bringing a halt to this pagan worship and to this pagan practice of offering their children through the fire. Later on, through history though, we see that it would become a dump for Jerusalem. Their refuse, their rubbish, their garbage would be burned there. Dead animals would be taken out there to be burned. Cripples who had been killed would be taken out there. Their bodies would be taken out there. Even the bodies of those who had been slain in war would be taken out there. It would be a constant fire that was burning. It tells us, at least legend tells us, and again, we'll take it for what it's worth. They tell us that it was there that Judas, on the side there, south side of the valley, that Judas would hang himself, and that potter's field would be purchased with the money that was given to him to betray the Lord. Well, as we continue to study concerning this valley, its reputation made it where it could be used as a symbol and could refer to that eternal damnation, that eternal punishment that would be brought about upon the wicked. This would unfold through the period of the 400 years of silence. And then when we come to the New Testament, Jesus Himself would use that term, Gehenna. And that's where it comes from, the Valley of Hinnom. And it would refer to the destruction and the place where those who were wicked, those who did not lean upon God, those who turned away from Him. It would be the final abode of those who were unrepentant. It would be a fiery abyss, Mark chapter 9:43 says. It would be a lake of fire, Matthew 13, the words of Jesus, verses 42 through 50. It's where the godless would be, as we look at Matthew 23:15 and 13. And so we see again a very symbolic valley that would bring about a divine truth, a spiritual truth. The lesson is obvious. And it's a lesson our world needs to hear today. It's a lesson our brethren need to be reminded of. Not everybody, not everyone is going to go to heaven. That there is a place prepared for those who do not the will of the Lord. I was talking with a friend of my son's just this weekend. And his grandfather was a preacher in the Southern Baptist Church. And he spoke, and we talked about some of the differences and some of the things that separate us. And one of the problems that he had in his mind was the division and just how many religions there are. And his answer was, therefore, if we will just believe the gospel, if we will just accept Jesus Christ, then that's all there is to it. We continued to talk. Another issue that he had that was weighing heavy on him was the idea that God would punish some who may not have had the same opportunities. As I tried to speak with him, I let him know, well, who hasn't had the same opportunities? I said, the Bible's been here all this time. And everyone that you and I know, the Bible's been here present for them. And they've had an opportunity. And I talked to him about those who ask and seek and knock and the providence of God that will provide for that. And I spoke to him concerning Matthew chapter 7. I said, you're going to have to come to the understanding that most people in this world are going to be lost. It's not a very pleasant thought. It's not something that we would necessarily like to meditate on and dwell on, but it is definitely something we have to think about. I think some of my brethren have forgotten that point. They think that all we have to do is we have to be immersed in water and then we rise up and everything's done. We've got our ticket punched, as again Brother Ramsey used to say. Who think the totality of our religion is nothing more than coming in when we assemble and sitting down and then going home about our business. Well, as we consider the Valley of Hinnom, it's a constant reminder to us that there is a place reserved for the wicked. And those who will not completely and totally, along with the idea of the verse lesson this afternoon, allow God in every aspect of their lives, allow Him to be the center, focal point, allow Him to enthrone Himself within our minds and our hearts, then we too may be needing to learn the lesson that we find here. Valley of Hinnom. As we continue, there's another valley that is mentioned. In fact, two valleys that are mentioned. And as we look at Joel chapter 3, the valley of Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat means judgment, the valley of judgment, and the valley of decision. It's one of those passages that we grow to expect in the minor prophets and in the prophets in general, for that matter. Where we hear the rebukes, we hear the strong language, we hear them dealing with the rebellious people, but as they go, there will be times when they will stop and they will show that lining, that silver lining, that ray of hope that shines forth. And predominantly, it is dealing with that time of the Messiah, the Messianic age. And it's a promise not only to Israel in the prophets, but it's a promise for all men. You see, as we go through the various contexts, Joel 3 would be one of them. Amos chapter 9, where it speaks of the breaches of David's tabernacle being repaired, would be one of them. Obadiah chapter 17, you go to the latter chapters of the book of Jeremiah as he is bringing forth the woes and the burdens upon those nations that were round about. He's going to give them that hope that yes, you too can benefit from the Messiah. It won't be as a nation, he would tell them. In fact, he would tell Israel that also. It won't be as a nation. Israel lost their national identity when they went into Assyrian captivity. But those individuals that will come and tie themselves to David and to Judah and to the Messiah, the seed of David, the root of David, as we see in Revelation chapter 5, they too will benefit, but we still fight. And it's a point of judgment. It's an either-or situation. And it is a valley of decision, and we have to make up our minds, and we need to understand what's at stake when we make up our minds. When we choose to follow Christ, when we choose to follow God, when we choose to do His will, deliverance will come. That's the way of hope that He's given. It'll be through the Messiah in that age that you and I live in. But if we turn our backs on Him, it doesn't matter who we are or where we're from. If we're from a Gentile nation, if we're from Israel, if we're from Judah, if we turn our backs on Him, then we made the wrong decision. We made the wrong choice. And so we stand there in the valley of decision. A lot of times as we study concerning these valleys, it seems a lot of it predominantly is negative. The battles that went on, the loss of good men such as King Josiah, as we see in the valley of Megiddo. We see the valley of Hinnom and it being representative of a figure of hell in the torment of those who are going to be cast out and separated from God in eternity. We see the valley of decision and we're reminded of the words of Jesus and the fact that He taught us that most that walk in this world are going to be lost. Those are negative thoughts in our minds. Those aren't very positive truths, something that's pleasant to us. But we remember as we turn to the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 37, where Ezekiel will speak of the valley of dry bones. He's told to look out over the valley, and what do you see? I see bones out there. They're all separated. They're all sun bleached. They're dry bones. And then he hears the noise and the clattering, and he's told to turn and look again, and what do you see? Those bones are gathering up. The sinew is gathering. The muscles are gathering. And these bones are coming together, and you see first that he sees there with the skin and the bodies now, but there's no life in them. But then he looks and sees the life that is in them. And he said, you go tell my people that. You see, Ezekiel was laboring the same time that Jeremiah was. Jeremiah was back in Jerusalem. Ezekiel was over in Babylon. And he's writing unto these people, he's speaking unto these people, he's preaching unto these people whose hope is gone, whose hope is dead. Oh, what can we do? And he says, we're like those dry bones. Here we are in captivity, and it looks like there's no hope, but those bones came alive, and there's hope. We're going to be restored. We're going to be brought back. Brethren, we look at the Lord's church today, and I don't know that there's anyone in here who is familiar with the history of our church, the recent history, who is familiar with the situation that we find ourselves in today as the people of God. I doubt there would be anyone in here who would say that things are exactly as we would hope they would be for the church throughout the world, that things are exactly as Christ would want them to be. In fact, as we look across the horizon, we see again too many times Satan is winning, even among our brethren. And we see so many times we hear of this congregation and that congregation. We want to go visit an area and we see an area and we could look in the phone book and see 50 congregations that claim to be the Church of Christ and yet there wouldn't be a handful of them that we could worship with, that we would recognize as far as New Testament Christianity is concerned. And it's real easy for us to let our heads hang down, our chins get low. But we got to understand that we are a people who have hope. We're a people who have God with them, and our God is a God who desires to forgive. Our God is a God who longs to forgive, and a God who longs to bless. And so we look across the situation, and we know it's not lost. There are a lot of things that are very positive that we can trust in, that we can lean upon. There are a lot of things that we can look at, efforts such as this, that encourage us and build us up. And we see the bones gathering, and we see the muscle gathering and the skin, and then we see life breathed into them, and we know and realize that our God is alive, that He is well, and that He is with us. We look at our own congregation sometimes and we become discouraged because we see out among those that we love so much and that we're so close to and that we're concerned about and we care for, and we see many of them aren't investing themselves as they ought to in spiritual matters. We see oftentimes in our congregations those who have no concern about God's will. We wonder sometimes why are they here? That the idea of quote-unquote church is nothing more than a social activity to them. They like to come, they like to visit, they like to go home about their business. And we wonder sometimes. We look across congregations of the Lord's church, and too often we see congregations filled with adulterers because their marriages are not what God wants them to be. We see our congregations are filled with those who are materialistic and covetous, just like their neighbors. They're putting their emphasis and they're putting their priorities in the same area. But there's hope, because there's another valley that we read of in the Bible. In Joshua chapter 7, we read of the valley of Achor. You remember Achan took some of the spoil when they overcame Jericho. God said, don't do that. He buried it in the floor of his tent. And then as they were so victorious over Jericho, they go to face Ai, and they're unable to overcome them. It'd be kind of like Austin. They come in and they overthrow Austin, then they go on down south, they overthrow San Antonio, and then they come to Natalia. There's some here in Natalia, you see. And they can't overthrow Natalia, and they wonder what's going on. And Joshua prays, and God says, get up. There's a time to pray and there's a time to act. There's sin in the camp. Deal with the sin. Well, when we turn to Hosea chapter 2 and verse 15, and here's a lesson that many congregations need to hear today. God said, I give you the valley of Achor for a door of hope. We wonder sometimes why we're not growing. We wonder sometimes why we feel like we're spinning our wheels and we're not really accomplishing anything. It might be that we need to open that door of hope, the valley of Achor. What's his point in Hosea chapter 2, 15? Discipline. There's sin in the camp. Get it out of here. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. The Corinthians needed to learn that. There was sin in the camp. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And so we have that valley of Achor for a door of hope, where if we will do things the way God says to do it and expect our members to do things the way God wants it done, and when they do not follow and walk after the precepts of God, when they step out of line, then we do what we can do to bring them back. We'll deal with that tomorrow afternoon. And finally, if we are unable to bring them back, we do what is one of the greatest acts of love that we can do, and we withdraw our fellowship from them, hoping and praying and longing for the fact that they will repent and come home. Great valleys. I suppose the last valley that we want to look at might be a little disappointed if we didn't bring it up. And I think it really brings things together for us. After all is said and done, after all the battles are fought, after we meditate and contemplate the eternal destination of men, heaven or hell for that matter, after we realize and understand that the decision is to be made, that there is hope, but it's going to come at a price, and that we do have responsibilities toward our brethren, we have this great, great valley that we can overcome. In Psalm 23 and verse 4, yea, though I walk through the valley. valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For Thou art with me, Thy rod and Thy staff, they comfort me. You see, it's a passage that each one of us will go through. It's a valley that each one of us will trek. But Hebrews chapter 2 tells me that our Lord blazed that trail for us. And He overcame death. And that great passage of victory, as we look in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 18, I'm He that is alive and was dead, and behold, I'm alive forevermore. You know what the next statement is? I hold the keys of death in my hand. He overcame the strong man. He bound the strong man. Spoiled his goods. And now He holds the keys of death. He, through death, destroyed the power the devil had over death. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. Providing the victory. So that we, with the Apostle Paul, can say as we look death in the face, O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? Christ has given us the victory. And yea, though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we shall fear no evil, because He walks with us. Thank you for your attention.